Hi, Katie.
Hello. How are you, Dominic?
I'm fine, but I do have the novel coronavirus. I tempted fate in the show last week by saying, I think I'm about to get it. And I did.
You kind of cursed yourself.
I did. On the other hand, I feel like I need to take back my slander against trains. I suggested that I was going to get it because I'd been on so many busy trains. But in the end, I just got it from singing in a rehearsal with a group of people who all got it. And I mean, they've been saying that singing is a risky activity, and it is. But fortunately, I'm okay.
I'm glad to hear it. I got mine from a quite fancy British supermarket chain that I'm not going to name, but it did make me feel like I had a sort of classy version of COVID.
So you didn't get it from Tesco's?
Thanks. Just ruined our chances of having a sponsorship from Tesco's. Other supermarkets are available.
How have you been, Katie?
I've been fine. I've mostly spent this week worrying about Wordle, not the English version, which is being sold to the New York Times, as you may have seen, but the other language versions of this phenomenally popular word game. What's going to happen to them? Because I've been playing the French one, and loads of people have been playing like the Portuguese version or the Norwegian version. Have you been playing in any language?
I've been playing in English, but it's funny you should say this because I was just on Twitter seeing someone saying how difficult the French version was. Is it hard?
It is hard just because you think every word in French has an E in it, and actually it's not the case. My boyfriend showed me a version the other day that I think you'll appreciate. It's called Cordel, and you have to guess all of the notes in a musical chord.
Ooh,
it's really horrible and hard.
I love that. I've been playing Queerdle as well, which only has queer words. But it's a good question. Who runs all these foreign versions, and like, who owns the copyright?
Are they all going to get shut down? That is the threat that is hanging over us. Anyway, that is enough talk about COVID and Wordle. What are we talking about this week?
This week, we're going to head to Venice, unfortunately, only virtually. We're going there to talk about a building that sits along the entire length of Venice's most famous square, Piazza San Marco. The building is called the Procuratie Vecchie, and despite being one of the most photographed buildings in Europe, it hasn't had the public inside it much over the last few centuries. And only this year, it's going to reopen with an exciting new social purpose. We're going to be speaking to Emma Ursic, the executive officer of an NGO called the Human Safety Net, who are going to be taking over the entire third floor of this incredible historical building. That's coming up later on in the show.
There's the COVID cough.
But first, it's good week, bad week. Let's start with bad week. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
I'm taking on a thorny one this week. I'm going to give bad week to the EU's plans to label gas and nuclear energy as potentially sustainable forms of energy. This is part of an exciting thing and a now very controversial thing called the EU taxonomy. For those of you who don't use that word very often, like me, a taxonomy is basically a system of classifying things. And in this case, what the EU has drawn up is a taxonomy for sustainable investments. It's basically a list of things that you can invest in. And this is the EU saying, if you want to invest in XYZ, that's great. You can go to sleep at night with a clear conscience. But if you want to invest in this other thing, don't do it. It's very bad for the climate and makes you a very bad person.
Is it just a moral judgment? Like, there's no consequences for investing in the worst things?
Well, yeah, I mean, as far as I can work out, it is just a kind of set of guidelines for investors. And actually, one of the main reasons that the EU decided to come up with this list is that, as you may remember, the EU thinks of itself as relatively ambitious when it comes to fighting climate change. And so it has this goal of being climate neutral as a block of countries by 2050. And that isn't just going to happen on its own. We need to direct resources away from bits of the economy that are really bad for the climate and direct them towards less damaging economic activities. And the EU is working off the assumption that private investment is going to be a really big part of this journey. Mm. So they want to give investors some pointers and give them a labelling system so that if they invest in things that the EU says are good and environmentally positive, the investors can go around loudly trumpeting how ethical they are and feeling good about themselves, and the economy itself gets cleaner. Everyone's happy.
Except the EU wants to like put gas and nuclear on this list. So gas as in the fossil fuel and nuclear as in the thing that makes all that waste.
Well, in some form, yes. And that is why lots of environmental activists have been very, very angry with the European Commission this week. The EU has stressed that this rating comes with lots of caveats. They're not saying, you know, natural gas is completely fine and unproblematic. because it is a fossil fuel and burning it does produce carbon dioxide. Nobody is denying that. What they're saying is that a new gas plant or a new nuclear plant would be considered a sustainable investment under this classification if the plant meets certain criteria. So for a new gas plant, for example, it would be under strict limits for how much CO2 it would be allowed to pump out, and it would have to switch to using a low carbon kind of gas by 2035. And for a nuclear plant, it would be able to describe itself as green if it is able to safely dispose of radioactive waste. But there are loads and loads of criticisms that have emerged of these conditions that the EU has come up with, and environmentalists basically don't think they're anywhere near tough enough.
So how did the EU Commission end up making this what sounds like quite a controversial decision? It smells a bit of lobbying.
It does. It's no secret that massive multinational companies spend huge amounts of money lobbying the people who make policies in Brussels. And actually, if you're interested, there's a think tank called Influence Map, who did a lot of work tracking how the gas industry in particular has fought really hard to ensure that gas is seen as part of the future of Europe's energy policy. I'll post it in the show notes. So private companies in the nuclear and gas industries have been lobbying hard. But the national governments that host those companies have also been taking quite strong positions and lobbying themselves. So France, for example, is famously pretty pro-nuclear. We get about 70% of our electricity from nuclear plants. And unsurprisingly, throughout these really fraught negotiations to try and come up with this taxonomy, France has been leading this faction of pro-nuclear countries who wanted nuclear to be considered a kind of clean energy, along with some others, including Poland, Hungary and Finland, just to name a few.
And that is a big debate in the environmental scene, isn't it? I know like some environmentalists, like even someone like George Monbiot, does say that for now we do need to have nuclear energy if we're going to transition the economy away from fossil fuels.
Exactly. Those countries like nuclear in principle because it's got a really low carbon footprint. There is the whole nuclear waste thing, which is another issue altogether. But when you look at a country like France, they've also got pretty serious vested economic interests in encouraging investment in nuclear. EDF, which is the state-run energy company that runs all of our nuclear plants, it already has revenues of like 70 billion euros a year. And like, wouldn't it be great if there was even more private investment in the industry and it created loads of jobs? So France is just one example of a country that really wanted to see nuclear included in this taxonomy as like a nice, friendly, good, positive thing to invest in. So that's the pro-nuclear countries. On the other side, you've got some countries saying that gas, okay, maybe it's not a perfect fuel, but it is less polluting than coal. So shouldn't we be encouraging that to be used as part of the transition, especially in countries like Poland that still use loads and loads of coal? Germany was the biggest country pushing for gas to still be given that role. It is a country that uses quite a lot of gas itself. And as you know, there's a big old pipeline that's supposed to be bringing gas from Russia eventually, maybe. Even though Germany's new coalition government was really divided on it and some ministers were really unhappy about it, Berlin ended up pushing for gas to be used, at least while we wean ourselves off coal. So there's definitely countries that have taken a strong national stance in favour of gas or nuclear. But you also have countries that are really unhappy about either the gas thing or the nuclear thing. Countries like Denmark and the Netherlands weren't happy about the gas. And on the nuclear front, there's a couple of countries that are so unhappy about this plan to call nuclear sustainable that they're threatening to go to court over it. Austria and Luxembourg have said that if this goes ahead, they're going to take it to the European Court of Justice.
Wow. Okay, so is there a situation where this plan doesn't actually end up happening then?
Yeah, and not just because of this threat to take the whole thing to court. This whole thing is still just a plan that the European Commission has come up with. And right now, the European Parliament and the Council, which is the heads of all the national governments, they have 4 months to look at this taxonomy and to potentially object to it. The European Parliament could veto it. And some MEPs are super pissed off about it, so that's not impossible. If the national governments were going to veto it, they'd have to have 20 out of the 27 governments turning against it, representing 65% of the population, which feels like a pretty high bar. But I don't know. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this whole thing has been a public relations disaster. The European Commission has been trying valiantly to argue that this is about being pragmatic and, you know, more than anything, we need to use less coal. So shouldn't we be promoting all of the options that are better than coal, even if they're not perfect? And sure, you can make that argument, but I don't think the Commission really understood how this was going to go down with the public. I don't know about you, but when I first heard about this, my first thought wasn't like, wow, isn't the European Commission brave for doing something that's difficult but necessary? My first thought was like, oh, great, like yet another example of a policy that's been dictated by lobbying.
Yeah, well, my first thought was that I was like quite surprised how much this decision had like cut through, that it was really like up there at the top of the headlines last week. And I also thought, God, this is terrible publicity for the EU and really doesn't look good in the broader scheme of this whole European Green Deal. So even if there is some reasoning behind it that's trying to ease Europe off coal, I mean, that's happening anyway. So it doesn't seem like a very sensible decision to me.
The thing that seems especially depressing is that the whole point of the taxonomy, or one big part of it, is that it's supposed to help prevent greenwashing by making it easier to identify whether investments are sustainable or not. But it feels like what this taxonomy really equates to is saying, you know, go ahead, here are some really slack standards that investors can say that they've adhered to, and then pat themselves on the back and tell everyone that they're environmentally responsible. It'll actually allow more greenwashing. One thing that I think is a real shame is that the European Commission actually set up a panel of experts to advise them on how to do this. And then they promptly ignored pretty much everything that the panel said. But one of the things that the experts had suggested is that this taxonomy could have had a amber category of energy types that are not as bad as coal, but not as good as like solar or wind. And that seems to me a really sensible way of thinking about it. It got rejected because apparently it would have taken too much time to negotiate. But anyway, as I say, it is not over yet. There are still a couple of hurdles to jump over, and it really does feel like the current plan has bombed with the public, and maybe this time that public reaction will make a difference. Who has had a good week, Dominic?
It has been a good week for whales, because Iceland has signalled that it is going to stop giving out whaling licences in 2024 when the current quotas for whaling would need to be renewed. Whaling is a very controversial practice, obviously. It's the hunting and killing of whales. And it has been banned by the International Whaling Commission since 1986 due to many species of whales nearly becoming extinct. And Iceland is one of only three countries in the world who are currently breaking that moratorium on whaling and allowing commercial whaling. The other two countries are Norway and Japan. And actually, one of the main reasons why Iceland are probably going to ban whaling is because demand for Icelandic whale meat has completely collapsed since Japan resumed whaling itself back in 2019. Japanese consumer demand for whale meat had already been steadily declining. And now that Japan are also hunting for whale themselves, there is really not that much demand at all for Icelandic whales.
I'm slightly ashamed to confess that I didn't even know that whale hunting was still a thing in Iceland. I had heard about it in Japan and the controversy about that, but yeah, I had no idea. So what are the current quotas for how many whales can be killed in Iceland?
Well, at the moment, Iceland gives out licenses for the killing of up to 209 fin whales each year. It's a species that's endangered and the second largest species on this planet.
Wow.
And they also license the killing of 217 smaller mink whales. But the Icelandic fishing minister, who put a piece in an Icelandic newspaper this week making this announcement, said that in the past 3 years, only one whale has been killed off the coast of Iceland. So this ban is maybe not that surprising and won't change much in reality, seeing as it seems to have become pretty economically impossible for these whaling companies to carry on hunting anyway.
Interesting. Is that just because Japanese people aren't eating whale as much as they used to?
Well, that is a big factor, but the pandemic was also causing some difficulties in the meat processing plants. And it's also the fact that Iceland had brought in a broader no-fishing coastal zone, meaning that boats had to go much further offshore in order to hunt. And this made the practice even more expensive. The two main license holders had suspended all their hunts over the past few years. So it's not a huge surprise that the fishing minister would make this announcement. But it has, of course, been welcomed by environmental activists who have been fighting for the end of whaling in Iceland since the practice started again in 2003, when Iceland started with this so-called sustainable whaling approach.
Sounds very like the nuclear and gas thing.
Yeah, actually, you're right. It's not so far off it. It's been a very contentious topic, this sustainable whaling thing, since the International Whaling Commission declared their full ban on whale hunting in the 80s. Countries like Iceland and Japan expected the full ban only to be temporary whilst it was worked out how they could hunt sustainably without endangering these wonderful aquatic animals. This never happened. The Whaling Commission kept the ban in place, and Japan, Norway, and Iceland at different points resumed hunting and killing whales, even though they knew they were going against this international moratorium. Mm. Iceland argue in their sustainable whaling approach on their government website that whilst, yes, the fin whales are officially listed as endangered, the populations are in a much better condition in the Northern Hemisphere than in the Southern Hemisphere. And this policy was, for quite a while, quite popular in Iceland. But over the past 10 years, opinion polls suggest that it's lost its majority support pretty rapidly, actually. So it makes total sense that the fishing minister would make this announcement. Opinion polling about whaling might sound like a pretty niche thing, but actually whaling politics are like quite a hot topic when it comes to election season in Iceland.
I imagine it's not actually great for Iceland's public image either.
Yeah, indeed. Some actually argue that it was actively damaging the Icelandic economy. Back in 2006, Whole Foods, that huge American food chain, decided to stop marketing any products from Iceland in protest to the whaling policies. There's also an argument that whaling damages the other more economically successful and less murderous whale industry in Iceland, which is whale watching, something that apparently pre-pandemic was getting around 360,000 visitors in Iceland each year.
Why do you think whaling, this idea of killing whales, causes such an emotional reaction? Because when we started talking about it, you know, your instinct is to just be like, no, not whales. We love whales.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think we, or me anyway, feel emotional about the killing of any animals that are endangered. But I did actually see a few years ago a Japanese official who accused critics of their whaling policies as eco-imperialists. The argument is that here in much of Europe and in the West, we see whales as these majestic animals with impressive migratory movements, and we're in awe of their cross-ocean communication skills. But traditionally in Japan, whales are meat. And this official said that the criticism was about emotion, not about science, because they say they are hunting relatively small numbers of whales in populations that they claim have at least somewhat recovered.
I guess it's a bit like how a lot of people in the West tend to have a very emotional reaction to the idea of eating dogs in some parts of the world, or like guinea pigs.
Well, exactly. Yeah. So there is almost certainly some hypocrisy that we are so disgusted by the killing of whales, but yeah, continue to eat pork and beef, which in other cultures is really disgusting. We don't all continue to eat pork and beef, of course. I'm not suggesting that. But I do think it's easy for us as Europeans to be critical of whale hunting because most of us haven't ever eaten it, unless we're Norwegian or Icelandic, and don't want to eat it and don't need to eat it. But in Japan, whale meat was apparently the most eaten meat in the decades that followed the Second World War. It was just much more normal there. And it's true that the meat industry in Europe is also pretty horrible when you look into it. Mm. Some argue that the non-whale meat industry is more cruel than the whaling industry in terms of the conditions for animals in captivity. Whales live a free life in the wild and are hunted. But even if there is a level of hypocrisy in some of this criticism of whales, I don't think it should stop us from trying to save the whales. I also don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with the fact that there is an element of emotion in the criticism of whaling, especially when combined with the facts we know about what happens in whaling. For example, we know how they are killed, and whilst techniques have apparently improved over the years, whales are usually killed by having a harpoon fired at them, which contains grenades that explode inside them after entry, and hopefully kills them quickly, but sometimes leads to a pretty slow death or requires subsequent harpoon shots. Mm. Also, there's the fact that they just have enormous brains and seem to be pretty emotionally and socially intelligent. And there's some research that suggests that whales even communicate with names for each other. How can we kill animals that are clever enough to communicate with names?
What, you mean like they have different sounds that they use? They're like, oh, hi.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that a good whale impression?
That was definitely a dolphin sound, but fine. But perhaps that means that they also have a great capacity to suffer. I know it's controversial to like create a hierarchy about which animals to save and which not, especially when there's so much we don't know about animal sentience. But I can't help but think it's more cruel to kill a whale than, say, an oyster, for example.
Controversial. We're going to get the oyster activists coming after you now, Dominic.
Oh, dear. There's also a really strong climate argument for the protection of whales that our producer, Katz, told me about. Whales soak up an amazing amount of CO2, and if they die naturally and fall to the bottom of the seabed, they take that carbon with them, and the carbon can stay at the bottom of the seabed for centuries. Whereas if they are hunted, their population numbers are obviously devastated, and also the carbon from the hunted whales is released immediately back into the atmosphere. And that's before we even get into the climate benefits of their poop, which I'm not even going to get into now, because it's a good week for the whales who swim in the water around Iceland, and I've got a bit off track.
Sounds like whaling should be in the taxonomy.
No! If you're feeling like you want to hear more about whales, because I could have rabbited on about them for a lot longer, mainly thanks to some amazing facts from our producer, Katz Laszlo, then I recommend you go and listen to a piece that she made, a short radio piece called Whale Falls, about some musicians who were inspired by this incredible phenomenon. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Something very delightful and mysterious happened this week. I don't know if it's just that the gods are smiling on us, or maybe people are just feeling super generous for some reason. But loads of people signed up to support us on Patreon.com. Massive thanks go to Anna Brachtendorf, Lisa Lang, Nuno Santo, Barbara Maxwell, Anda Valenza, Allegra Fornaca, Claire Gardner, Sam Wilkin, and Ron. Just Ron.
You can join them by heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast and cheering up our week by putting some coins in our monthly pot to keep this podcast up and running. It would make us very happy.
Yeah, that list was so long just now that it makes it sound like we don't need donations, but we really do. We'd love to start paying ourselves a little bit better to deal with this whole inflation thing. So yeah, you can give us a helping hand and we'd be super, super grateful. Have you ever been to St. Mark's Square in Venice, the Piazza San Marco?
Yeah, when we were at university together, Katie, I actually went to Venice for 10 days with fellow students to like do these amazing acoustic experiments in the Basilica.
Oh, no way.
On St. Mark's Square, this famous church. It was the best gig ever. We got to try out different positions in the Basilica and sing the music of Gabrieli and Monteverdi, all these composers, amazing Italian Renaissance composers who'd composed in these buildings, and like try and work out where it was that the singer stood.
That's so cool. Do you remember the building running down the side of the square, though?
Well, I remember mainly that there are all those like chairs on the square, like all those cafes that you can sit under the arches, right?
Have a really, really expensive coffee, yeah. Exactly. But this building down all one side of the square, the Procuratie Vecchie, it's basically a really fancy row of terraced houses with these beautiful arches underneath. And for quite a lot of the last few decades, it's been mostly empty. However, change is afoot. This very historic and much photographed building has been undergoing a major renovation. They've brought in a fancy architect, David Chipperfield. He's the guy who redesigned the Neues Museum in Berlin. But it isn't just cosmetic. The purpose of the building is also changing. For the last 500 years or so, the Procuratie Vecchie has been mostly closed to the public. Our guests will tell you a little bit more about the history of the building, but for the last two centuries, it's been held by the Italian insurance company, Generali, which had its offices there. But now everything is changing. The revamped Procuratie Vecchie is going to have workspaces for nonprofits and startups run by refugees. It's going to have art exhibitions and art studios. It's going to have an auditorium for public events, a cafe. The idea is to make a space that was private for centuries feel more like something that belongs to Venice as a whole. The new building is going to be the headquarters of Generali's philanthropic arm, the Human Safety Net, which supports disadvantaged families and refugees. And their director, Emma Ursic, has been very involved in this intriguing project to give a new lease of life to one of the most historic buildings on this continent. We gave her a ring in beautiful Venice. The big idea is to make this beautiful building open to the public. But for a really long time, centuries, I think, it was reserved for politicians and for royalty. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this building? Who were its previous occupants? What were they doing there?
Originally, it housed the Procuratori. That's why it has the name it has today. And they were high officials of the Venetian Republic who looked after different things in the city, from private wealth in the city, but also tending to the needs of the poor. After some time at the end of the Repubblica in the 19th century, then it also became, among other things, the seat of the insurance company Generali that is behind the foundation that I lead today. And so what we find quite nice is this mission that the procurators had, and in a way, with the work we want to do in the Procuratie through the human safety, we're kind of bringing back this work in a way that we think is fit for the 21st century.
I was really excited to speak to you, partly because I'm just really pleasantly surprised to hear that this building isn't being transformed into a luxury hotel, despite sitting in this, like, one of the most tourist-filled squares in the world. Is it part of the thinking behind this project that you want to give this space back to the people of Venice? And if so, how will the people of Venice experience it?
We're very excited about the new mission of the building, because the amazing thing about being in such a historical place is also to give it a life that is very contemporary and also engaging to people. So not just a place where you go and visit and you enjoy the architecture, but also a place where you can also be a part of the activities and also cater for lots of different kinds of people, both Venetians and visitors. So we will have an event space. We would like to hold conferences, concerts, and all sorts of activities also with the local community. We will have a co-working space. The idea is there to work on our projects, to bring the people from the countries where we have our programs running to co-design things and then bring them back locally. And we will have an exhibition space. And we really hope it's a place where people will be happy to come back. So not just visit once to see the place and say, okay, I've been there and I've seen it, but actually be interested in the activities and want to come back and be a part of the wider community.
So the revamp of the building is being overseen by Generali, the insurance company that has owned this building for nearly two centuries. If you don't mind me saying so, there's not really a very obvious business case for what they've decided to do here. I mean, yes, it's like good branding for them to be associated with this positive idea of giving the building to NGOs and refugee startups and all of these like interesting positive projects. But they could have made some serious cash by turning this into a luxury hotel or something like that, right? What is the rationale behind doing all of this?
Well, first of all, we have one floor as a human safety net. We'll be hosted in the third floor, which used to be the servants' quarters. We will be there. And then on the other floors, there will certainly be revenue generating activities, because, of course, that needs to be a balance between the expenses and this more social mission. This is kind of part of the wider sustainability approach of Generali. And the city itself is also, you know, discussing a lot about the future of Venice. And there's this new project of Venice World Capital of Sustainability. So the idea is that one of the three floors of the building will be devoted to this.
Presumably it's a bit of an advantage being on the third floor, also because we all know that Venice is at risk of flooding. How is the building and how has the transformation of this building been set up for taking that risk into account?
Actually, Piazza San Marco is one of the lowest areas which gets flooded more than other neighborhoods. The Mose barriers are helping a lot in that, because above a certain level, these barriers kick in and avoid the square being taken over by the water. Of course, it is a risk, and colleagues from the real estate have done a lot of work to make sure that there's a protection on the ground floor in the moment the water rises, that it doesn't actually, you know, permeate and destroy even the higher area. So that there's been, you know, as much prevention as possible, but our hope is any kind of damage is limited.
The other big problem that Venice has struggled with in recent years is over-tourism, and that has affected everything from like the rental market to the environment. Was it important that this building ended up being for the people of Venice who actually live there primarily rather than tourists?
We'd like to have both audiences engaged, but we really believe that it's important to have the interests of the local community also at heart in the work we do. It's true that tourism has been both kind of the reason to be for Venice, but also one of its main issues. And it will be interesting to see now that the COVID pandemic is slowly, you know, going away, I hope, to see what happens next and, you know, what the new future brings. And what we feel in terms of the offering that we bring with the new hub of the Human Safety Net is that we have a place where people can gather in a square that normally, especially in late afternoon and evenings, is not so frequented by the locals. It's a place where we'd like to, you know, have work happening and have local events happening, and where people kind of have it in their horizon that it's a place where you can come and hang around and, you know, see your friends and maybe do some work in the cafe. That's the kind of idea we had, and hope that we will be a part of the solution to making the city of Venice more livable for the people.
I get the impression that there was maybe a little bit of skepticism amongst some people in Venice over the project at the very beginning, that the idea of bringing in a foreign architect to remake this building that is so integral to Venice was maybe a little bit controversial. Do you think, having seen what is the very, very near end result, that Venetians are going to be convinced that David Chipperfield has been respectful in the way that he has remade this super historic building?
This is very much my hope, of course, when we actually throw our doors open, and that's going to be in April. I guess it will be for the people to say, but what I feel, and having also experienced all the various stages of this work, this kind of really painstaking work of trying to identify what is the soul of the building that you want to preserve and what new elements can you bring in that fit in with harmony. And there was a bid for ideas, and there were many ideas that came in. And the project of the David Chipperfield Architects, I think, went further in trying to really study the building, understand its essence, and then bring something in that would be fitting in without going too far. Many decisions were taken to actually leave the reading of time and the changes that were made so people can actually, you know, see and feel the history of all the features that you were starting from the bricks that were there. So everything has been maintained in a way that you kind of read the centuries.
I think it's really important that this building has a podcasting studio. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And we have to go there ASAP. Why don't we run a travel podcast?
We can make this a travel podcast maybe once travel is really a thing again. The new and improved Procuratie Vecchie is reopening in April. Do check it out if you're visiting Venice, and do be a responsible tourist while you're there. Thank you. What have you been enjoying this week?
This week, I started this new like blockbuster podcast from the New York Times and Serial, which is set in Birmingham, England, which is why I'm allowed to talk about it here on a European podcast. It's called The Trojan Horse Affair, and it's a really intriguing series. It's produced by two people, one of whom is Brian Reed, who made S-Town, and the other of whom is like a total novice to podcasting, an ex-doctor living in Birmingham who was about to start a course in investigative journalism and got talking to Brian after one of his live events. That conversation led to this huge 8-part series that tries to get to the bottom of a mystery in Birmingham to find the answer to the question, who wrote this infamous letter that landed on a city councillor's desk in Birmingham? A letter that suggested that there was a secret plot by Islamist extremists to infiltrate schools in the city. A letter that then caused a huge wave of national panic and media hysteria. But without anyone actually getting to the bottom of who wrote this letter and is what's in it actually true? I've only listened to the first few episodes, but I'm really enjoying it so far. I think you've started it too, haven't you?
Yeah, and I'm also really, really enjoying it. The story's got so many interesting elements. The sort of backdrop of racism in this like very multicultural city, Birmingham, is really, really interesting. But there's also this really interesting story of like personal beef just between people, which is so fascinating. And the other thing I really like about it is this kind of interplay between the two hosts, between Brian and Hamza. Because Hamza is like a local guy and a Muslim, and you know, he experiences a lot of discrimination just walking around. And you really see that kind of coming out in the way that he and Brian interact with each other, a conversation about that, which I thought was really honest and interesting to see.
Yeah, go and check it out, everyone. It's really good. What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, actually, I'm going to borrow my isolation inspiration from a listener this week. Shout out to Britta in Lisbon, because I'm going to pass on a TV show that she recommended, Gloria, which is a Portuguese series on Netflix. It is set during the Cold War against the backdrop of Portugal playing both sides while they continue to disastrously lose in African colonial wars. Britta says it features murdery communist spies, Salazar's secret police, great cinematography, and a great soundtrack. She says that it's Mad Men meets John le Carré in Portuguese. Can't wait to check it out.
Sounds great. And actually also reminds me I should thank Britta for bringing the Icelandic whaling story to my attention. Britta's been very good on the Facebook Patreon group. Thank you, Britta.
We are doubly indebted to you this week.
My happy ending comes from Switzerland this week, where some innovative scientists have, for the first time ever, helped a man with a severed spine to walk again. A young Italian guy called Michel Roccati was paralyzed 5 years ago after a motorcycle accident, and it was assumed that he would never be able to stand or walk again due to the total severing of his spinal cord. Mm. However, these scientists put an implant on his spinal cord that sends signals down to his legs, helping him walk. It's absolutely amazing technology, but still very early days, so it will need much more testing and research, but it could hopefully become part of a treatment for some people suffering from paralysis. What clever Swiss scientists.
Science is amazing, isn't it?
It really is.
All we do is make a stupid podcast.
A stupid podcast that'll be back again next week.
Yeah, next week we're turning our attention to the housing crisis and the insane prices of housing in many parts of Europe. Might not sound that cheery, but it is a really good interview. Don't miss it. In the meantime, give yourself more screen time. You can find us on Twitter at EuropeansPod and on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
Thank you to Katie Lee and Wojciech Oleksiak for producing this episode. And also thank you to Kat Laszlo for being such a great help with the whales. We are a part of the Are We Europe audio family. You can go and check out their other audio offerings at areweeurope.eu/audio-family.
Hasta luego, everyone.
How do?